Blog Talk Radio.
Coming to you live as we do every Monday at this time. Thanks for listening and being part of the radio voice of Eastern Airlines. We've covered so many subjects over the past 5 years plus, and most of them are about the airline we hold so dear to our hearts, Eastern Airlines. Tonight we have a guest who will tell us a few good old stories. But first, let's do some housekeeping for our little kitchen table radio show. I guess on a commercial airliner, this would be described as the aft galley radio show. We hope you'll participate and be on board our beautiful Boeing 737-800 aircraft and be a part of our show. For those listening to the broadcast on their computers, all you need to do is to call us at 213-816-1611, and it'll put you on Neil's producer's board. He can He will open up your phone's keypad and to join in. But those of you who cannot listen on a computer can still hear and participate by just calling the number you just heard, 213-816-1611. Also keep in mind, your telephone microphone picks up any noises that might be in the background, so make sure you mute your telephone or keep as quiet as possible during the broadcast. If you prefer to listen on your computer, you can tune in by going to www.ealradioshow.com or www.repaonline.com. At either of these websites, you'll see a radio icon that says Blog Talk Radio. Just click on the arrow in the circle at 7 p.m. and join us for Eastern Airlines Talk Radio. Now let's get flight 269 launched in the air.
Eastern 269, are you ready for takeoff?
That's affirmative, Miami Tower. We certainly are.
Roger, Eastern 269. The winds are from the east at 5 knots, and you're cleared for takeoff.
Roger, Miami Eastern 269 is on the roll.
Well, it takes just a couple of seconds to spool up those engines, but the roar of the jet engines for takeoff is sure a good sound. Tonight, we have a special guest, Captain Jim Holder, a former Eastern captain who now holds the position of editor of the retired Eastern Pilots Association's REPA magazine repartee. He also serves as the director of REPA and its online website. And the website is repaonline.com, which we advertise as one of our sponsors. So you can listen to us There are at EAL Radio Show. Hello, Jim. Yeah. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Neil. I'm glad to be with you guys tonight.
Well, Jim, let's see. I think you've got a story or two to tell, and yeah. I have written a few of your stories when I was the editor. Hang on a second. Let's see who else is talking in the background. I'll tell you, folks.
Him remain in the house for life.
Oh, okay. Let's see. I think that's an area code 305, so I think that. Yep, I identified 305 as our blind host here. I mean, blind radio host that comes in from time to time. And but at any rate, Jim Holder, you told some great stories, and I printed some of them in the magazine, which you are now the editor and doing a fine job, Jim. And
thank you.
So,
thank you.
I've heard some of your stories, and I expect to hear a story or two from you tonight. I like to think of Jim as what's that guy's name? Garrison Keillor, who does the the Lake Wobegon Lake Wobegon stories. I tell you, I don't know how a person can do stories like Keillor does, but Jim, you'll probably do just as well, and perhaps since he's retiring, you can take his place. Jim, you've been on the show before as a call-in listener, and I'd also like to compare you with another editor, now deceased, Captain Bill Malone. You know, Johnny Carson once said that if God didn't want man to hunt, he wouldn't have given us plaid shirts. He also said, this is Johnny Carson now, also said that he only kills in self-defense. What would you do if a deer pulled a knife on you? Hey, it makes sense to me, Carson says. Well, how about it, Jim? Why do you hunt, Jim? You've been doing it for years and years, but probably you don't even take your gun out anymore. What is it? The food? The hunting camp? The camaraderie? What the heck is it, Jim, that brings you back to the hunt club?
Well, let me tell you. I'll tell you what little bit that I want to talk a little bit about the hunt club, and then I got a few stories I might can tell you. But for the listeners, I grew up in rural Mississippi, and wild game played a very large part in what we put on the table. The squirrels, rabbits, doves, all kind of fish, quail. Interestingly enough, back then there were practically no deer in Mississippi. I never even recall seeing a deer track, to be honest with you. And certainly that's not the case now because, like in Georgia, the imported deer from Virginia, the whitetails and the redheads from Wisconsin back in the 50s and 60s have really multiplied, and Georgia and Mississippi are both loaded with deer now. And actually, you asked about me hunting. I still go down there, but I haven't gotten a deer in several years as my knee problems have really cut back my time in the woods. And certainly I cannot hunt from a deer stand up in the trees now. I fall out just trying to get in it, and I'd probably never be able to get down if I got in it. I have to sit in the ground blind, and that cuts down the chances of seeing and actually getting a good shot at a deer. I did miss one last year, but it was a long shot, and it was almost dark, and I could come up with a bunch of excuses, but I flat just missed. Anyhow, I do enjoy the camping and sitting around the campfire with the guys. That's a very good part of it, and we tell a lot of stories, and they seem to get better with years, and but they're still stories. No, that's not true. They're all true. What am I saying?
You know, Jim, this is one of the reasons in Georgia I had problems with the deer. In that everywhere you drove down a country highway in Georgia is always a deer crossing. And I used to stop for those deer to cross, and I never did find any deer crossing anywhere near those signs. So
yeah, that's
I just said
that's
the heck
regular.
With it. But about 3 years ago, I did hit a deer with my car, and it was 3 o'clock in the morning, and he just kind of snuck up on me, and I thought I hit a bicyclist, to tell you the truth. And next morning it was a deer. But I want to kind of set the stage for you, because I can just kind of visualize the Eastern Airlines Hunt Club, and hunting camp just wouldn't be a camp unless it had the sounds of a campfire going. And so I don't know whether this might set the mood for your stories or not, but I guess I'll see if I can start this darn fire. Oh, there it is. I think it's burning now, Jim.
Well, it's not the Hunt Club. It'd be us down there cussing, trying to get a fire started in the rain.
Yeah.
That's more likely what would you hear.
All right, well,
We do have some good fires down there.
I had crickets and everything else in this campfire, and it's just not doing what I want it to do. So you take
all
over
right.
and tell us a story or two, Jim. Good to have you with us.
All right, well, I got three or four, but I'd like to talk about the Hunt Club just a little bit, if that's okay with you.
Sure, absolutely.
All right. Well, we call it the ELPHC. That's the Eastern Airlines Pilot Hunt Club, and it was established in about 1967 in Jasper County, Georgia. I joined in 71, and my son, Mike, like many other sons and grandsons, grew up in that hunt club. Mike started sitting in the stand with me at about 10 years of age. We have a big stand big enough for a father, son. But at age 16, he was able to hunt by himself in one of our stands. Our rules allowed that. Well, Mike's 53 years old now. He's an Air Force pilot with almost 30 years service. But he still comes out deer camp whenever he can work it out. And fortunately, he can do that maybe every couple of years. The Hunt Club is about 7 miles north of Monticello, Georgia, which is about 40 miles southeast of Atlanta. And I will say this, if anyone listening saw the movie My Cousin Vinny, very funny movie, then they saw Monticello, as the courthouse on the town square was a locale for many scenes of that movie, even though it was supposed to be in Alabama. The opening scene where the convenience store clerk is shot is just west of Monticello, and the park where the couple gets stuck in the mud, if you remember they were out there doing what people do in the mud, I guess, was filmed on part of our land, but not during deer season. It's a very funny movie, and I've watched it many times, and I'm sure some of the listeners probably know Eastern Captain Walt Shelton, who unfortunately is deceased, but he was in that movie. He was an extra. And he was in the Heat of the Night and quite a few others. But I'm digressing a little bit. I'll get back to the Hunt Club. A long time ago, back in the day, I think it was 1988, a local real estate company handled the leases for many hunt clubs down there in Jasper County. In the fall of 88, they had a front yard, a great big yard, barbecue in the home at the home of the owner of the company for all the hunters that wanted to come. At that year, I was president of the Hunt Club, so I attended along with a few members. And they had a big pile, a great big pile of bags of pecans, which were given as prizes to the clubs, with the biggest rack, heaviest deer, and so on. Another category was the oldest club. Several hunters got up and said, well, we've been here since the 80s. And another couple of guys got up and said, that's nothing. We've been here in the 70s. But another got up and started walking up to get the bag of pecans and said that they started in 1970. And I stood up and said, 1967. Well, that won us a bag of pecans. And we won another one for the most bucks so far that year. And we ate a lot of pecans around the campfire that we got going that year. And it's out in the woods, like most hunt clubs. And when we started it, we were way, way, way deep in the woods. There was only one old house on the dirt road, which is a gravel road now, in our camp. And back then, we had about 1,250 acres and close to 50 Eastern pilots, most of who just hunted during the daytime. Over the years, we've had probably over 100 pilots that joined, Neil, and a lot of grandsons and sons. And we do have a history, and we keep a list of deceased hunters in what we call the blue box. It's nailed to a tree down there, and we record our deer harvest. You get a deer, you come in, and you got a tab, and you put it on there, and we got it out of the rain. Sometimes people put coyotes in there. And last year we had a very unique award put in there because, and I'll name him later on, one of our hunters shot my tear in my deer stand, my ground stand. He shot the leg out from underneath it. And, you know, that's a cruel guy that'll do that to a guy that has knee trouble. And we finally did an investigation, and we put two and two together, and we identified him. And I went up and put a deer tag. I put a tag in the box that said that guy's name got one camp, one stand chair. And that is a true story. If I'd been sitting in it, it would have gone probably behind my left leg, but it shot the leg out from underneath that chair. And when I went down there to hunt it the next day, I was very surprised. I thought it had been vandalism, but it wasn't. Well, anyhow, civilization's closing all around us. We only have about 500 acres now, 23 members. About half of that are not Eastern pilots, but rather sons and grandsons and the pilots and other airlines. We got to have people to pay the insurance, and the leases cost a lot of money, so we have to keep bringing people in. We allow our daughters and granddaughters to hunt as guests, but they're not members. We even have some Delta pilots, and one is a former Eastern pilot as members. And actually, we got one retired FAA controller who used to work at Atlanta Tower. Our oldest member right now, Sid Lanier, who's 93. And like me, he can only hunt from a ground stand. His son, Gary, a very, very, very senior airline captain, he's number two at his airline, also grew up in the hunt club, and he has served as our president for the last 10 or more years. Very few of our members, very few, are day hunters now because most of us have RVs or some sort of tent. And because of that, we've got all the guys down there not day hunting. We do have quite a social club. I resigned from the Board of Governors last year. I was on for 24 years, and the present board consists of four sons and a retired Eastern captain whose son is a longtime member. And I'll get back to that retired Eastern captain again later on. I'll tell you I'll tell you who it is. And but we're certainly keeping an Eastern family, even though we have to bring in some members from other locations and pilots and airlines and all that. And that's a little history of the Hunt Club.
Well, Jim, why do you need a board of governors? I mean, do you guys sit around with Robert's Rules of Law out there and talk about
Lord, no. Man, I leave that at Reaper.
Okay.
No, well, that's the last thing we want to do. We want to drink and tell lies and stories and stuff, not do Robert's Rules of Order.
Okay. No second motions.
No, we need a board of governors because we do. You got to keep a roster up, and we have to have insurance, and we have to have leases, and they have to be notarized, and there's all kind of paperwork going into Hunt Club. When I first joined, it was like $25, and you just came down there and hunted. That was it. No insurance required or nothing. Now it's $450 a year, which is actually pretty cheap for a hunt club. And but we have to have insurance, and you know, and somebody has to deal with the loggers that come in periodically and cut trees. And we have neighbors now, and sometimes neighbors bring problems. Although most of our neighbors out there, they are hunters and such too. So we don't have too many problems with the locals.
Okay, and you
but
got what
governors,
about a
you gotta have one.
You got about a 2 month season.
It starts around the third Saturday in October and generally ends January the 1st is like, well, I think the 31st of December is the last day. Now, some of that is does only, or sometimes it's no does, and sometimes you got restriction to a deer has to have 4 points on one side. You can only get 2 bucks, and one of them has to have 4 points on two side, on one side. And you can have two of the great racks, but you got to have at least one. You can't shoot two spikes, is basically what I'm saying.
Okay. From our listeners, you have any questions for Jim before he launches into a story or two? I don't think.
I guess not.
My board, Jim, my board is completely full, absolutely full. When I
well,
say
they
full,
must, they must.
I'm limited to 25 people on this board, and I got 25 folks here. So
they're waiting for the good.
They're all waiting. Yeah, they're waiting for
they
the good stuff. That was Dorothy.
Somebody
Dorothy.
Said they had a question.
Well, let's see. I got Jerry Frost. Probably Jerry's on. You got a lot of 770 phone numbers here. And if any of your local Hunt Club members are on the line, please say hello to Jim at least.
Hello, Jim. Mm.
Hey, how you doing? I don't think you're a Hunt Club member, are you?
No.
Who is that?
That's Dorothy. She's the editor of the EARA newspaper.
Oh, yeah, yes. I've exchanged quite a few emails with her.
All right. About Hunt Club? You'll have to have, Dorothy, you'll have to have Jim to write an article or two for the EARA newspaper about the hunting club there.
I would love it. Thank you.
But, Jim, how
and
about
Dorothy,
launching? Go ahead, Jim.
No, I just want to say, too, it'll be in time, New Roman, and 12 font. How's that? She
how
won't, that's what she wants. That's what she wants when I do the REPA luncheon report. She wants Times New Roman and 12 font.
Okay.
All right, well.
All right. Yeah.
It's those demanding women, what can I say?
Yeah.
Well,
that's
another,
very
you
easy, Jim,
too.
Believe me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, I want to hear this story that about whatever you're about to tell me, Jim, or
well,
us.
Well, it's just a story from the Hunt Club. I got three or four of them, I think. And they're at least the first three, anyhow, Hunt Club related for sure. And we had a game warden down there based in Monticello. Matter of fact, I mentioned the courthouse. He was his office was in the basement of the courthouse. His name was John, and I can't think of his last name right now. And John was a no-nonsense guy. He took his job very, very seriously. You know, you may have think about a game warden. Well, he was that on stage. We knew that, and with one exception, we gave him no reason to levy a fine on any of us, but you never knew when he dropped by, so we pretty much followed the rules. Some years ago, way before cell phones, it was probably in the mid-80s, one of our hunters came up on a marijuana patch in a secluded part of our woods down by a creek called Herds Creek that borders our property, and it's close to water. Any of those guys that do that want water for their plants. We didn't know what to do about it, so we decided to go to a local country store and call it in, and somehow the message got to John, the game warden, and he quickly came to our campsite. I mean, very quick. As usual, he was alone and he ordered several of us to take him to the patch. And I ended up in the front seat of the patrol car. And I'm here to tell you, I could barely get in due to all the radios, pistols, shotguns, batons, radar detectors, extra ammunition, hunting knives. I think I saw a bazooka in there somewhere. And that thing was loaded. And I commented, he had more stuff than deputies and state troopers, city police, you know, those guys. And he snapped right back at me, and I mean he snapped like that. Unlike those guys, he was quite often alone in the woods with armed bad guys, and I didn't say any more about his equipment or anything else. I kept my mouth shut. Anyhow, we helped him pull up those planks, and he kept a few as evidence or something like that. And I might add, though, that in spite of our history of helping John in the drug war, one afternoon, from the gravel road, he spotted one of our hunters, the son of an Eastern captain, about 200 or 300 feet into the woods, sitting on his hunter's orange jacket. Now, you're not supposed to sit on your hunter's orange jacket. You're supposed to wear it. And it was a warm afternoon, and this fellow was using his jacket as a cushion. So old John went up to him, told him, "Empty his rifle, get down," and he wrote a citation for not wearing 500 square inches of a hunter's orange above the waist. But this is the guy we helped with a drug war, remember? And he even used a GPS to record the exact location of the heinous crime our club member had committed. And what do you think that fine was? Give me a guess, Neil.
I have no clue, Jim.
$184. That's pretty expensive. I'll tell you right up to you. Yes, sir. And that was one of the son of that was Chad Sandusky's son, incidentally.
Yeah.
But yeah. And he's still a hunter. Matter of fact, he's on the board now. So
that game warden was kind of like an FAA guy, wasn't he?
Yes, he was very much like an FAA guy. Except he was better armed. I got another little story about that's It doesn't have John in it, I don't think, but it's a story that guys might want to hear, and Dorothy, too. You want to hear that one?
Oh, yeah,
sure.
Please.
Okay, I think it was the very next year, and it was cold, and it was a real clear day. There was a number of us down there hunting, and I and several others came by the woods early, the ones seeing anything, and we were standing around the campfire, which is just about in the middle of my camp area. It's sort of hard to imagine this, but I camp, think of our deer camp as a great big circle, and right in the middle of that circle, the little bitty circle, and that's the campground, and right in the middle of that little bitty circle is our fire. It's right there handy for everybody. But one of the guys said when he came in, he saw a little yellow car parked down the road by the bridge, and that's the bridge over Hurd's Creek that I was talking about a while ago. And we were wondering whose car that might be, because this was way back then. There wasn't a lot of traffic on that road. And we were just wondering what it was, and we saw one of our hunters coming up a trail from the woods down by the creek, and the leaves were off the trees, so we could see his bright 500 square inches of hunter's orange vest, and we noticed that it appeared that someone was walking with him wearing a purple jacket. Now, this is quite a surprise to see somebody in deer in the woods and wearing a purple jacket. It doesn't quite meet the requirements. And this is very surprising. Like I said earlier, no one's supposed to be there, no matter what they're doing, whether they're clearing firing lanes or working on stands or test firing a rifle or anything. You had to wear a hunter's orange, and they were real tough on that, as Mr. Sandusky found out. Well, that hunter was George Zupko. The retired Eastern captain that I mentioned, who is still on the board of governors, and I will tell you right now, he's the one that shot my damn chair. And George was captain for Eastern later on, and I never missed a chance to remind him of shooting my chair. He was practicing with his rifle on the file on the cable line, and he knew there was nobody down there, but Wade put his target on and shot his target. It lined up perfectly with my chair. He later became chief pilot at Kiwi. And he was VP of Flight Ops at another one. I forgot the name of that. Well, anyhow, George and this lady, they come on into deer camp, and she was quite friendly and told George that she stopped over on the gravel road by the bridge. And so now we solved the mystery of who's driving the yellow car. And told George that she stopped there because she had to go pee. And so she got out of a car and entered the woods, generally walking parallel with the creek. And she took care of the peeing bit, but got turned around somehow and became lost. Now listen, the visibility is great, the leaves off the tree, she's driving a yellow car, so there was good visibility, and just think, how far do you have to go in the woods to pee? Yeah, she wasn't lost, she was looking for that marijuana patch. Because George's stand was about 600 to 700 yards from the bridge. You got the picture?
Yeah.
So we don't know what to do, so we're sitting around talking to her, and she's having a fine time, and a little happy, giggling and laughing, and she said she wanted to join up and was going to be our cook. And I think there was five of us there. I think it was Charlie Newcomber, let's see, Jim Duncan, I think, was there, Don Thiel, maybe a few others. You probably know those guys.
Yeah.
Somebody took a picture, because I've seen that picture, but I can't find it in my computer anywhere. But yeah, it was clear to us she was high as a kite. And we were 99% sure that she was really searching for that marijuana patch just to get a little higher. Well, after about 30 minutes of chit-chat, you know, we stood around, and I'm sitting there thinking, are we going to stand here all day talking to this woman, or what are we going to do here? I don't know. And she asked for a ride back down to her car. She had to get going. Well, I had my ATV, so she hopped on behind me, and off we went. It was about 3 minutes and about 400 yards down the road to the car, and I pulled up next to the driver's door. She hopped off, turned to me, looked at me, and very clearly said, I slept with Kenny Rogers. I'm not kidding. The singer, you know. She jumped in the car, cranked up, and took off like a rocket. George says she passed the gate to our campsite. I mean, really going, like 70 miles an hour, throwing up the dust like you wouldn't believe. And when the dust settled, I rode my ATV back up to the gate real slow, thinking, what in the hell did I just hear, you know? And I turned in, and they asked me, they said, what happened? And I told him exactly what I just related. Nothing was said by me or her except the revelation about her sleeping with Kenny Rogers. You never know what you're going to see or who you're going to meet in the woods for. You better keep your pistol with you. That is a true story. And when I say it's a true story, that means it's a true story. Now, if I say it's almost a true story, you know it's a lie.
Well, Jim, your stories are like the true stories of Hassan Callaway. And when Hassan told a story, you knew it was true.
On him. I could tell Hassan Callaway stories a lot.
Yeah. We'll do a whole program of those stories. But I've got the campfire fire cranked up. It's flickering and crackling. And I just wanted to, you know, I went to a great length of pulling out some sound effects for your stories around the campfire. And did you ever hear this one here?
Yeah. That was like a probably lost in the woods.
That's the old hound dog.
Oh, that was the guy who shot the leg out from his chair.
That's old Brummian Bullet.
Well, I can't even stop the hound dog from hounding.
me and George always seem to attract dogs down there, and we ended up with a Tennessee Walker one time. And I ain't got time to tell you the stories about that Tennessee Walker dog we had. But George and I adopted two or three dogs down there, and I adopted a cat, too, which ended up with Jim Gardner. It was a kitten when it crawled up my leg, but it turned into a cat. I had to get rid of it. Jim Gardner, the president of REPA, owns that cat now. That's a whole different story. I got another game warden story if you want to hear it.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right.
Folks, go ahead about your dinner and listen in. Jim's got another story.
This is another true story. I mean, I didn't say it's partly true. I said it's true. It is true. And it involves old Johns, the game warden. And one day we was all down there, and I wasn't there. I left that morning for some reason. I came back about 3 o'clock, and I heard the story. And what was that?
Shaving?
Anyhow.
That's a hunting member, club member shaving.
Sounds like a blender.
Yeah.
Let's see if I could pick that one off.
Be there.
Yeah. Well, anyhow.
Go right ahead.
Okay. Nobody was known to be in the woods, and George Lupko again, the chair shooter. They heard a shot very close by, very clearly on our property. So George jumped on my ATV. Like I said, I'd gone home, and I live about 25 miles north of the hunt club. But two or three other guys jumped on theirs, and off they went. Find out who's shooting there on my club, because nobody was in the woods. And they went around a curve in the road, and they saw a pickup truck stop on the left side. Now, pay attention to all this stuff. I had to read it because it's so complicated. Stopped on the left side of one of the roads going east through our lease land. And the driver appeared to be looking north out his window, if you can picture this. When he saw him coming up behind him, and he took off, but not before they got his tag number. And there was no way they could catch him on an ATV, so they turned around and came back to where it happened. And George, he's telling me the story later on, a couple hours later, George immediately saw an empty hull, and I believe it was a 248, laying on the road, which had been freshly ejected, which goes along with the shot. And as the driver stopped on the north side of the road and appeared to be looking into the woods, they walked in that way to see what they could find. And they went in about 100 yards or so, George said, and they heard a truck coming back in a big hurry. It stopped for a second by the ATVs and then took off westbound at an even higher rate of speed. So there they were, George and two or three other guys with nothing but an empty hull, a 248, and a tag number. Well, by this time, we had cell phones. So they called the game warden's office in the clubhouse and got you-know-who, John. And they told John what happened. Well, John, in very short order, met him at the crime scene. There seemed to be a lot of crime at our hunt club, where George, who was the president of the club at the time, told him the story and how they searched the north side of the road out to 100 yards, didn't find anything. John, the game warden, said, well, I see the deer. As he was standing on the road, but he was looking south, not north, and there was a doe laying over there about 10 feet off the road. The boys went into the wrong direction when they went looking. Well, John said it appeared the deer had been shot some distance into the wood and then drug to the edge by the road, and the purchase were about to load it, I guess, when George and the others came running around the curve. The shooter ducked into the woods, and George and them didn't see him. He was hiding. And, of course, when the driver came back, he jumped in the truck, and they hauled butt. Well, I told you about John and his car, and he has all these radios and everything. So he ran the tag right there. And he found that the owner of that truck lived in Marietta, which is about 100 miles north, as you know. That's a long way to come to do some poaching. He got the fella on the phone and told him to be at the Monticello Courthouse in 2 hours or he was coming to get him. And this was a very mean and mad John, and he meant it too. He said, bring your buddy and that .248 caliber rifle, too. So that clearly proved to the guy, Neil, that they better get down there in their time to hurry. And they did. They showed up in less than 2 hours, scared to death, and they confessed everything. And we later learned, I think John came by a week or so later and told us that the judge confiscated the rifle, and they were fined for trespassing, firing a firearm from a public road, hunting without a license, no deer tag, and shooting a doe out of season. And what do you think the fine was for both of them together?
Oh, $500?
Probably $500. Right at $4,000.
What?
Oh, my goodness.
Right at $4,000.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
The judge let the guy keep the truck. That's about all. They don't like poachers in Jasper County, believe me. John was a mean game warden, but he gave us the deer. He tagged it and gave it to the hunt club. We donated it to a retired city of Decatur, Georgia police officer whose land adjoins ours. He deserved it because he keeps his eye on our property all the time. I know that $4,000 seemed pretty high, but that's just what we heard. That was them together, you know, not just one of them. That's a true story, too.
Hassan Callaway, true.
It's real true.
Okay. All right.
I'm sorry, Hassan, if you're listening up there.
Hassan, he's listening up there. You know, I've got another sound that I probably should have used during that story, but how about this sound?
That's yards up, go shoot with my deer stand. That sounds like a 30-30 lever action. How many bullets has he got?
I think that somebody else has found a shotgun sound effect.
Yo, can I get out from under my desk now?
Yeah, George. Well, you know, Jim, before I let you go, and we've got a few things else, other things to talk about tonight, but boy, this has been a treat. But I'm not going to let you go because I was talking to Captain Jerry Frost the other day, and he said I had to ask you to tell the story you told him. And even though it's not about hunting, I want to hear that story. And I think our listeners would be interested in it, too. Can you tell us about that, Jim?
Well, I can, I'll try to keep the bad words out. But,
no, don't do that.
We're not censored here.
You're not censored? Oh,
I don't have
a
little
burn,
noise that
I don't
want
to burn Dorothy's ears. Well, this story, you know, me telling Jerry that story occurred because M.E. Moore died, Milton E. Moore, Captain Bill Moore. You know, we had two Bill Moores in Atlanta. We had old Bill Moore, and we had young Bill Moore. And a lot of people thought when I put the word out about Captain M.E. Moore, Bill Moore, that it was young Bill Moore, but it wasn't. It was who we called, and then he called himself old Bill Moore. young Bill Moore, W.T. Moore, Bill Moore. He lives down around you somewhere around Jacksonville, I think.
Yeah.
And he was the president of REPA a few years ago, remember?
Yeah.
But it wasn't that Moore. It was the old Bill Moore. Did you know Bill Moore?
Oh, I knew him. And one of the greatest guys I ever flew with.
Yeah, I flew with him quite a bit. And this happened on a L.A. to Atlanta flight. And I just, you know, it just made me remember this flight, him passing away. And I was talking to Jerry on the phone the other day. Excuse me, got a hiccup. And about Bill Moore, we were trying to find an address for him so I could send his spouse checklist. And so far we haven't been able to find one. I know his widow's gone. But it was an afternoon departure from L.A., none south to Atlanta. We had laid over out there. And as I stated, Bill Moore was the captain. I was the first officer. And our second officer was Jimmy Crawford. And I'm sure you know Jimmy Crawford.
Oh, yes,
he's the
eldest
son of the famous captain Jim Crawford.
Jim Crawford,
and he had another son, you know, named Pete, who was all an Eastern pilot. And he's younger than Jimmy. And the airplane was a 727-100. It might have been a QC. I don't know. I tried to get my logbook out. And it was just about full of passengers. And we were departing to the west on the north side of L.A. Airport. And Bill was the pilot flying. And everything was okay till about 80 knots when suddenly the fire bell rang and the fire handle for the number three engine came on bright red. And Bill hollered abort and pulled the power back, top speed brakes, got on the banders. And stopping was not a problem because, you know, L.A.'s got long runways. Like usual, it was dry as runway. And about this time, the tower called on the radio and said it appeared that number three engine was, in fact, billowing smoke. As the airplane slowed, Bill called for the engine fire checklist, and Jimmy Crawford started reading it. And when he got to the fire handle, being the first officer, I reached up and I pulled number three quite smartly. And to my astonishment, the entire handle came off in my hand. I got a state here, and you know Jimmy Crawford. If you flew with him, you knew he had a bit of a stuttering problem.
Oh, yeah.
And there we're going. We're coming to a stop. I'm sitting there with this thing in my hand. And Bill Moore is over there trying to bring us to a stop. And Jimmy got so excited, he said, blanking, handle all of it, blanking, way off blanking. Put your own words in there.
Yeah.
And he and I have laughed about that a million times. You know, I read it. As a matter of fact, he flew co-pilot for me later on. And, of course, it wasn't very funny at the time. But I couldn't argue with him because I was sitting there looking at my lap, and it appeared that the rod, you know, the rod behind the handle, was still connected to the airplane, and all the stuff that was supposed to happen did, in fact, happen. And we exited the runway on the left side, right at TWA's gate, since we parked at TWA, and the tower said it appeared the fire was out. And so we eased on over, and they actually guided us into the gate. So we just went right back into the gate. We just left. Fire trucks came running up, but they didn't spray the engines or everything was out. We immediately deplaned the passengers in a very orderly fashion, and no emergency evacuation was needed. They went out through the jetaway. And very quickly, TWA maintenance and the firemen came in and confirmed that something bad had happened, but nothing was still burning. So we were pretty shook up by the whole thing, and we stayed in the cockpit trying to figure out how to write it up. Captain Bill was very, very, very worried about how to make a logbook entry. And after much discussion, we agreed that we'll just put down what happened. And I think we wrote down number three fire light / bell came on, aborted the takeoff, ran the emergency checklist, number three fire handle came off in the first officer's hand when pulled. All systems apparently worked okay. And I believe that's what we agreed to put in the logbook. But he was still worried about it, the whole affair, including the logbook entry. Bill repeatedly asked me if I thought we should add something else. And I told him, and Jimmy Crawford agreed. I said, I think we've done it right. You know, we just told him what happened, and we don't have to do anything but just tell him what happened. Well, obviously, the flight back to Atlanta was canceled, and after we got a breath and settled down a little bit, we decided to go back and eat our crew meals. You know, we had good food on those L.A. flights, Neil. You remember don't you?
Oh, yeah.
And we had
yeah.
first-class meals, so before we went back to the Marriott, we decided just to go back there and eat our supper. And the flight attendants were already eating when we went back there, so we just joined them. And I was thinking, looking over at Bill eating his meal, that he sort of settled down a little bit, and I said, well, he's going to be okay. And we were sitting there eating, and we heard some footsteps coming into the airplane from the front forward passenger door. It was three men in a coat and tie with FAA ID badges on their coats. And I said, oh, me. And one went into the cockpit, and the other one, other two, rather, came back to us where we were sitting. And they asked to see the captain, and Bill stood up to speak to him. And I'm sitting there with, I mean, I hope he keep settled, and but he was very composed, very much the captain. The FAA fellas said anytime the word fire is used on the radio, they're required to investigate the incident, and I believe that to be true. I mean, that makes sense. Well, Captain Bill just coolly and calmly related what had transpired, including the bit about the fire handle coming off when I pulled it. They had a few more questions, and the guy who checked the logbook came back and said he was happy with our write-up. So they thanked us for the short interview, said they had no further comments, and they departed. And we watched them depart. And as they went up the jetway, Captain Bill Moore slapped his heart with his hand loudly, stated, oh, God, and fell back into his seat. And I was proud of him. he held on, man. He was nervous, but he stood up, told those guys what happened. No problems at all, man. They never heard another word about it. To this day, I don't know what happened to the airplane. I mean, the engine.
Yeah.
We did hit it on the next day, and I never found out anything about it. And that is a true story.
I'm sure it is. Bill Moore was
I miss old Bill Moore. He's
with.
A good guy. He was. He was a great guy to fly with. He was 97, I think, when he died.
I remember I flew a trip with him. I was a flight engineer, I think, on the Electra, and he was a captain, and he had just bought a new car. And I asked him what kind of car he bought, and he said, when we get off the trip, and he said, you come take a look at it. He said, it's brand new on the market. And it was the first Mustang ever came out.
Really?
The first little Mustang,
man.
Yeah. And Bill Moore was driving one. And I went out to the parking lot, and I said, my golly, I can't wait to make captain. I can't buy no one of these things.
Well, we had some great captain. You know that?
Quite a guy. Yes, we did. But Jim Crawford and Jimmy and Pete, the Crawford family, that's a story that would take probably a two-hour radio show, and we probably wouldn't even get halfway through it, especially in Las Vegas when both Jimmy and Pete were gamblers out there, and they weren't welcomed in many casinos because they were card readers and they knew the game.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll never forget one trip I flew with Jimmy Crawford, the son, and he was flying second officer because he could fly very senior first officer. But he chose to sit in the back seat for a long, long time because he wanted to go out to Las Vegas and do his gambling. And we went out there one time, and the chief pilot, of course, had a haircut inspection from time to time. I forgot who the check captain was, chief pilot was, but in Atlanta. But you had to have your side burns mid-ear, and you couldn't have your hair touching your collar. And, of course, Jimmy Crawford was just the opposite. You know, he had a ponytail. And he had long sideburns like Elvis Presley. And on one trip, I flew out to Vegas with him as an engineer. He was my engineer. I was flying captain. And the flight attendant knew that he was wearing a wig. And that wig was for the purpose of taking that ponytail and tucking it underneath that wig so he would be in compliance with Eastern's regulations. When we got to Vegas, she came up there and pulled that wig off, and down came the hair and all. So it was kind of funny with Jimmy Crawford, but the Crawford family were something else. And
he was my co-pilot on a Reno flight one time. He was flying first officer, and and we laid over in Reno, and he couldn't gamble. He'd sit there and watch me play, you know, play if he lose some money, you know. And but
they
he
wouldn't
would,
let
couldn't, he couldn't they wouldn't let him play. And that, this is in Reno.
Yeah. Steve Thompson, you're with me. Did you ever fly with Jimmy Crawford?
Oh, yes. And I was enthralled with his card-counting ability, of which he was very quick to share his card-counting skills with me. And he gave me the name of his teacher. And that taught him to count the cards. And I was all set to take lessons from him, and I think it was $50 an hour back then.
Oh, my God.
And I was already had the savings stolen from my wife's account. And but I never carried through with it. I was interested in it. It was fascinating to me to listen to him.
I got Steve. I would get Pete Crawford when we had a 2 or 3 hour layover. I'd get Pete Crawford when he was flying with me. We would get back in the back and we'd get a deck of cards, and he would try to teach me how to card count. I never could learn that deal, but they were fun guys to fly with, and Eastern had a lot of them. We had a lot of people like the Crawfords and the people we've talked about tonight. And so I think it's what made a wonderful airline that people still think and talk about today, Eastern Airlines. And since we've just about finished this, I would like to say that the news was sad. Yesterday, when we learned that Muhammad Ali passed away, but the news today that we learned, and it's been posted on several websites, and the Eastern Radio website, the fact that Eastern Airlines did the last flight home for Muhammad Ali to Louisville, Kentucky, and from what I understand, I've heard several emails, read several emails that Muhammad was quite a fan of Eastern Airlines and flew it on many, many occasions. Anyone on the show tonight have any comment about Muhammad Ali? I'm going to open all the microphones. I don't care whether people are eating or drinking with their ice cubes. I'm going to open them all up, and we'll find out what kind of strange noises we hear from all open mics, and I've got 25 microphones to open up right now because I've tried to give Jim a little bit of quiet time to not mess up his stories. I hear a toilet flushing in the background. But literally, Jim Holder, you were a favorite tonight because I have had so many people that have tuned in and are listening to all the stuff that we're putting out right now. But any comments about Muhammad Ali? Yeah, I don't know where that Eric code 305 is. I know that's
Neil.
Yes, Jim.
Neil, I had Muhammad Ali on a flight when he was going to out to Houston to fight Ernie Terrell way back when.
Really?
Okay.
And I was the second officer, and he rode with me two trips with a trip in between, and sat in the front row with an escort. And he looked over at me the second time and said, "You were here again," like that. He was a very personable guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it really was great to see Eastern's airplane in the news today. And they've done so many great things right now that I have to applaud. I think all of the former Eastern employees should applaud the new airline because they're doing things the right way. They're doing many honor flights of the World War II veterans up to Washington, D.C. And then when I saw this flight that bore the coffin of Muhammad Ali and the news that covered that, I really felt proud to see the Eastern logo on the side of that airplane and see the fact that Eastern is still in the air today. And I must compliment the management. I don't know how they got the charter. If anybody knows, I hope they let me know. I do have a contact with their senior flight attendant instructor, Mark Harden, who's on our show from time to time. And he emailed me and wanted to know if I saw the fact that Eastern did the charter on that flight, and it was really, really great. It's a good feeling to see our airline back in the air again, even though it's a different corporation. When we see that airplane with that Eastern sign on the side, it makes us feel like that we're still flying, and I think we are. I think in the hearts of all of us, the employees of Eastern, the former employees, in our hearts, we feel like we still are part of the new Eastern Airlines, and we are flying. We still are flying.
Hey, Neil, this is Bob Furman.
Yes, Bob Furman.
I heard a story about Ali, and it came from my wife, Brenda, of course, who's a flight attendant, and I'm really hoping it was an Eastern story, but supposedly Muhammad Ali got on an airplane, and he was sitting up in first class. The flight attendant came down to him and told him, Mr. Ali, put your seatbelt on. And he looked up at her and said, don't you know I'm the greatest? I'm Superman? And the flight attendant looked back down at him very politely and said, Mr. Ali, Superman did not need an airplane. Put your seatbelt on, please.
I've heard that before. Yeah.
And I think
that's
that was
great. That's great.
Yeah.
But can I say one other thing? I don't know what everybody knows it, but the Boston Globe ran a story today on Eastern Flight 980.
Really?
Yeah.
And you can see it if you go to www.msn.com up in at the Boston Globe. And my brother-in-law called me from Illinois to tell me about it. So.
Oh, wow.
That has been quite a bit of the news, and I put it on the website that people can see the pictures that were taken on that expedition by the two gentlemen from Massachusetts that went up the mountain. And so maybe we can have some future discussions on that a little bit later in another show and a radio show. And there's more to come from that. Of course, we've talked a great deal about Flight 980. And I don't know where I'm getting all this background noise, but it seems to be coming through. But that's okay. This is the Happy Alley Radio Show. I thought about renaming Kitchen Table Radio to the F Galley Radio Show.
There you go.
George, do you have any comment? I hear your voice out there.
No, I'm just listening to Jim. I thought it was great. You know?
I thought the show was great. Jim Holder, you did a great
Absolutely
job.
Terrific.
And
well, thank you. I enjoyed it. I certainly did.
We did too, Jim. Thank you very much.
We also have one other thing that we should remember today, June the 6th was the D-Day invasion, the Normandy. Anyone like to make any comments about D-Day, which is today? What happened?
Yes, I'll do a little blurb.
Dorothy, go ahead.
D-Day is observed in the United States, and it's not a federal public holiday in the U.S., but it is the memory of the Normandy landings in France on June 6, 1944, in which American soldiers and other Allied forces fought to end the World War II in Europe. About 160,000 Allied troops landed on the beaches of Normandy, France, to fight Nazi soldiers on June 6th. General Dwight D. Eisenhower called the operation a crusade in which we will accept nothing less than full victory. More than 5,000 ships and 13,000 aircraft supported the D-Day invasion. And by the end of the day, the troops gained a foothold in Normandy. Thousands of soldiers lost their lives. Thousands more trekked across Europe to end the war. The invasion is one of history's most significant military attacks. Some museums and war memorials host exhibitions featuring photos, films, as a tribute to the soldiers today who were part of the Normandy landings. D-Day memorials and ceremonies are also held to remember these soldiers. Even in France, in the Colleville-sur-Mer, proud veterans in their 90s and families of fallen soldiers are commemorating the D-Day invasion of Normandy 72 years ago that helped the Allies defeat Hitler. In New York, a World War II veteran from Long Island who flew a bomber missions on D-Day is being honored with one of France's highest honors for help defeating the Nazis. And then in New York, Air National Guard Brigadier General Thomas Owens will be among those saluting 90-year-old Harold Smith during the ceremony Monday afternoon. The ceremony is being held at the Garden Center in Franklin Square in Nassau County. The former B-24 navigator is among the American World War II veterans who had received the Legion of Honor from the French government in appreciation of their service in France during the war. The National War Museum in New Orleans is planning a slate of events to commemorate the 72nd anniversary of the invasion of Normandy. June 6th will also mark the 16th anniversary of the museum that is considered one of the city's top tourist attractions. For D-Day, I don't know if everybody has heard about this before, the first time I heard it called, they have a tour of a Higgins boat. And the boats were named after New Orleans businessman Andrew Jackson Higgins, who designed and produced boats able to transport men and equipment from the sea to shore without using a harbor. The boats were used extensively during the June 6, 1944 D-Day landings in France. And, of course, I'll have newsreels and film footage of the invasion. That's it for me, Neil. Go ahead.
Hey, Dorothy.
Well, thank you. Yes, Don, go ahead.
Your father's got a French medal too, doesn't he?
Yes, he does, but his was World War One, and this D-Day was World War Two.
Right.
Well, it's been a great show tonight. Jim Holder, thank you very much for being our guest tonight. And, Jim, you've got a convention coming up very soon with the Retired Eastern Pilots Association. Would you tell us a little bit about that? Well, if I can find Jim Holder's microphone, I'll turn it back on. And Jim, bear with me. I think I found the 770 number. Is that you?
Oh, yeah, that's me.
Okay. Well, tell us about the REPA convention coming up at the end, toward the end of the year.
Okay, it's September the 6th at the Asheville Doubletree, and the 6th, 7th, and 8th, and you go home on the 9th, and we're going to have a ladies' luncheon buffet the second day. Of course, every night's a cocktail party, and on the 7th, the ladies' luncheon, the business meeting that morning, a buffet that night, and we're going to have Savannah Steve and those who were at Savannah a couple of years ago as our disc jockey entertainment, and that guy was tremendous. Well, we've got him to come all the way up to Asheville, North Carolina, at the, right there by the Biltmore, and he's going to be our entertainment that night. And then, of course, we got tours planned and all the kind of stuff that people can do in Asheville. And then we have a banquet on the night of the 8th. And as we've done for the last 3 or 4 years, the first 25 to make their reservation, their names are put in a box, and we draw from it on the banquet, and whoever's name is drawn gets a free night refund check from Jerry Frost. So it behooves you, if you're wanting to go and planning to go, to get your registration in. And also, that's a relatively small hotel, and we're limited on how many rooms we could get, so it may be that they might run out of rooms. So we hope that if you want to go, make your reservations with a Doubletree, And the Repartee magazine was mailed about a week ago, and it's got all the information in it. And, of course, you can go to the REPA website, the convention page, and you can download by hot buttons the registration form and its instructions. And send them on in with your check, and get maybe you'll win a free night. I know you'll have a good time.
Very good. Thank you, Jim. And shortly after that reunion or convention, we're having the second annual Eastern Pioneers reunion down in Fort Lauderdale, where we held it last year. Had great attendance, and this year our hotel is the Embassy Suites. And those reserving rooms there, it's $196 a night, which is a great, great buy, especially
it's
that time of year.
$129. It's $129.
$129, right. And that comes with a dinner. I mean, not a dinner, but a breakfast in the morning. And a dinner is a happy hour to me. So a happy hour in the afternoon. And so that all comes with the package, and we've got great great things that are happening at the banquet. We're honoring Captain Bob Wilbur and for the heroic landing and handling the hijacking of the DC-9 that left his first officer. He died in that incident, and they named the Hartley Building, our training building there, after Jim Hartley. But Bob Wilbur has been very quiet about taking credit for what he did, but he did a tremendous amount. He saved, as far as I'm concerned, and many the souls on board of that air. And so we'll have a great show there at the end of that. Jim Holder, I'm going to try to be there in Asheville, North Carolina, because it's only 20 miles from the college I went to back in the 50s, Mars Hill College.
Right.
It's now called Mars Hill University. So they've come up a step or two since I was there. And Steve Thompson, I think your mother went to Mars Hill. Is that right, Steve, if he's with us? I think he's gone to sleep. But at any rate, that's two of the events that are coming up. And Dorothy, you have anything extra to say about the reunion?
Well, on Friday night, we're planning the meet and greet, and we have two great entertainers. We've sat out with the ballroom dancers, two people that are going to demonstrate different dancing. And then we have a singer-entertainer, Richard Frank, who's been to Las Vegas and to the local areas in our Palm Beach County and several different counties. That's terrific. So I would like to urge everybody to sign up, send the registration form in to you. They can go onto your website, and there's the hot buttons there that they can use to sign up for the reunion and pay for it through PayPal and a credit card. And they also can go right into the hotel from there and sign up for the hotel. So it's going to be worthwhile for both nights, $125 per person, and we all look forward to seeing you. And one thing, Neil, why don't you mention about your class reunion that you'd like to...
When I mentioned Bob Wilbur, we're also honoring Vito Borelli, who has been the inspiration of EARA, the Eastern Airlines Retiree Association, and we're honoring Vito. So, we'll have a great time. I thought of the idea that we had a couple of years ago, a couple of classmates that when I was hired February the 11th, 1963, we decided that we would try to get a class reunion going. And we had three of us that met down in Miami, but we were looking for more. We didn't find but three people that were able to come. And so we're encouraging all classes, graduating classes, whether they be pilots, mechanics, flight attendants, reservation folks, if you had two or more people, think of having a class reunion at our reunion in September, September 23rd, 24th, and 25th, and we'll reserve a table for your group. We'll have a table there for your group, and you'll be recognized along with the other guests that we have. So we look forward to a convention, two good conventions coming up in September. Silver Liners just had one of theirs last month or month before last, and I was able to go over to that for a day. Very enjoyable. And so we want to keep Eastern alive with the associations that we have now, and the get-togethers or conventions that we have. They're all for the purpose of sharing memories, great memories, of a great airline, Eastern Airlines.
You also want to mention on the Homestead Funding being a sponsor, Neil?
Correct. Homestead Funding, Albany, New York, is funding our convention in Fort Lauderdale, the Embassy Suites. And we'll be talking more about Homestead Funding and what they have for you and in future shows. So I hear the song now that we...
I have a question.
But before we do that, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, it's actually more of a statement, but this is Mike Holder, the 52-year-old son of Captain Jim Holder that you mentioned earlier. And I was just wanting to take a moment to thank him for raising me, basically, at the Eastern Airline Pilots Hunting Club. Some of the fondest memories that I had involved that hunting club. And for those of you that know my dad, you have only heard about 0.01% of the funny stories.
Well,
amen. Thank you, Michael. I've really enjoyed the last hour. I'm a first time listener, but I actually talked to my father this morning, and he clued me in that he would be the guest speaker. So my fiance and I have been sitting out here on the back porch at Virginia Beach and hearing some stories, and I honestly can't say that any of them are the first time that I've heard them, but there are many, many more out there.
Well,
but thank you. Thank you very, very much there, Captain Holland.
Yes, sir. Mike, I think it's Mike, isn't it, Mike Holder?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. We have heard a story or two about you and what you did and what you did.
Well,
in your efforts. I'll tell you what. We're very proud of you, along with your dad and your mom, I'm sure. We're very proud of what you did for this country in service to this country, because your story alone would be very honorable on our show. We'd love to have that story. Maybe Jim can come back with you and tell the story that I remember hearing a few years back, Jim Holder.
Yeah, you're talking about the rescue over in the war.
In Vietnam or in Afghanistan. Yeah, I am. That's correct.
Yeah, in the mountains. You know.
In the mountains of Afghanistan. It was. Remarkable. And again, Mike, thank you so much for your service to this country.
Absolutely.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We're honored to have you with us, and we hope you come back often to our show, little Afghan radio show.
Well, thank you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, let's try this again. We can keep this show on about another half hour because I signed up for about an hour and a half tonight. But at any rate, we don't want to push a good thing. We normally land the airplane. Is anybody going to bring the airplane in for a landing? I don't know whether our hosts are still with us to do that part.
Chuck, are you there?
Well, if I turn his microphone on, he's there. Chuck? Well, I guess.
Winds are light and variable from the west at 10 miles an hour. and the present temperature at the airport is 82 degrees.
Well, Steve,
Eastern
did
flight,
you get... Go ahead, Chuck. You're the tower
Eastern
tonight.
Flight 269, clear to land. I guess our landing didn't squeak.
Well, no, I didn't.
Hey, well, it's kitchen table calling, folks.
The microphone and the captain's microphone is off, but now it's on. So, Captain, would you respond to Miami Tower?
I don't think so. I think we better land this plane.
I think we better land it. God, this is fun, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Now, if I can only find the landing button here.
Landing button.
Oh, there it is. It's a big button. It says land the airplane. All right.
Don't pull that number three
now,
fire in.
Now, hear this.
Great landing, Captain Steve. We had a great show tonight, folks. Mr. Producer, another outstanding job at the board. You know, it's always fun when you talk about Eastern Airlines and the place where we worked. We feel truly that we've earned the title of Radio Voice of Eastern Airlines. And it's all because of you, our callers, our listeners, our guests, hosts, and our sponsor, RIPA and the Homestead Funding. We look forward to our Eastern family and friends joining us next week as we broadcast our 270th show, traveling aboard our Eastern radio show, Boeing 737. You hope you will be with us again as we file our flight plan for a destination yet to be determined. Until then, we all say good night, Eastern.
Good night, Eastern.
And
good
we
night,
love you,
Eastern. We love you.